Thank you, Grace. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And it's a great pleasure and a privilege, of course, for me to be here addressing you all this evening. As has been said, the title of my talk is Advancing the Freedom of Religion or Belief, Agendas for Progress. It is far easier to speak of the freedom of religion or belief than it is to understand what exactly this freedom means, what, if anything, it requires, and of whom it might be required. The meaning to be ascribed to each of the words which comprise that phrase, the words freedom, religion, belief, is strongly contested. When considered as a phrase, the difficulty of discerning their meaning is magnified manyfold, and many times again when account is taken of the myriad viewpoints from which such meaning might be sought. Yet there is a near universal consensus that the freedom of religion or belief encapsulates an idea of worth and a goal to be realised. This is despite there not being a consensus on what realising that idea and that goal might actually mean in practice. So what can be done to further the freedom of religion or belief? In this lecture, I wish to focus attention on the manner in which that freedom is currently being engaged with in order to highlight what I consider to be a singularly significant opportunity to advance the realisation of at least some elements of that framework. As an academic public international lawyer, I am concerned with the manner in which the freedom of religion or belief is currently addressed as a matter of international human rights law. Perhaps I should also add that, although I do not draw a great deal on legal and human rights theory in my work and in my approaches, I do fully recognise that human rights thinking is merely one way of approaching the subject, and that many people, possibly some in this room, might have significant questions or difficulties with taking a human rights approach to it, at least in its totality. Whilst human rights law most certainly does offer legal protection to the freedom of religion or belief, it does so in a way which many religious believers find difficult at times to accept. For example, by the way in which it legitimises restrictions on some forms of religious activities in pursuit of other rights, goals or values. On the other hand, there are many who contest the legitimacy of religion or belief being accorded any special recognition as a human right at all, and who consider that the interests of believers are adequately protected by the more general freedoms of expression, of association, family life, and others. This has led to a particularly rich debate of late on the role of religion in public life, a debate which is set to run and run, I'm sure. We should be glad that it may do so, because such discussions do need to be put in a somewhat broader factual context. Whilst debate continues over the rightful place of religion in the public life of a liberal democracy, day in and day out, around the world, untold numbers of people continue to face the risk or the reality of restriction, hostility, violence or death on an individual or on a communal basis because of the beliefs that they hold or as a result of their real or perceived religious identities. Recent surveys, for example, estimate that some 70% of the world's population live in countries which are subject to quite extreme forms of limitations of religious freedoms. And in terms of percentage numbers of countries, that's around a third of the countries in the world today. At one level, there is something quite astonishing at the complacency of the international community when faced with the evidence of such levels of repression. It is almost as if such repression in the eyes of some seems to be only expected, or is something which believers bring upon themselves by choosing to believe what they believe or by believing what they believe in that particular place or at that particular time. In short, that since they are by and large the authors of their own misfortune, the remedies for their problems ultimately lie in their own hands. Behind this, however, does lie a deeper and far more serious reason for this relative inertia. The entire conceptual apparatus of the modern state and the modern international state system still remains grounded upon the political settlements arising out of the 17th century wars of religion within Europe, the so-called Westphalian system of sovereign states. And still, locked within that conceptual framework as we are, the idea of one group of states exerting itself against another group of states for the purposes of propagating religion or in order to protect religious believers takes us to places where we have been and to which few wish to return. As we know, the easiest way to undermine the legitimacy of any military intervention in the affairs of another state is to label it as a form of jihad or crusade. And the same holds true of interventions of a more political or diplomatic nature. There is a very fine line between raising legitimate concerns about the treatment of religious believers and being seen as championing the cause of forces antithetical to the interests of the state, not least because occasionally it may happen to be true. It is also true that states tend to raise interests of religious freedom largely in respect of and in response to pressure from the religious groups which have influence or dominant influence within their own jurisdictions. This adds to the sense of partiality or instrumentality about the manner in which this is done. I shall return to this point later, but for now we just need to acknowledge that there are a whole host of deep-seated reasons why it is simply not very easy, or has not been very easy, for the international community to respond to the situation faced by many religious believers in many countries. And as a result, the reluctance to do so, whilst perhaps dispiriting, is not necessarily irrational. It is then all the more remarkable that there is a potential tool that can be used by the international community to address these issues. And this tool is the language and the content of international human rights. And being realistic, I see no other way of making significant and sustainable progress in addressing the practical predicaments of religious believers other than by developing the framework of international human rights protection. This may not seem particularly controversial, but it is. There is, however, more. I think it is not only an option, but is fast becoming a necessity in order to prevent any further erosion of the position of religious believers in many countries. This will not be a comfortable message for those who just do not like the way in which the application of human rights thinking has generated outcomes in some high-profile domestic situations, for example, such as cases concerning wearing of religious symbols in the workplace, in schools, and in cases concerning attitudes to sexual morality or orientation. I would, however, respectfully suggest that this may be something which we are going to have to, if not live with, perhaps more positively work on. For without wishing to sound too apocalyptic, there is really rather a lot at stake. And certainly, whilst not trivial, such matters of these are perhaps not quite of an order to justifying rejecting the more general contribution which human rights thinking can bring to the protection of religious freedom on a worldwide basis. Moreover, like it or not, international human rights law does now provide the framework within which issues concerning the enjoyment of the freedom of religion or belief are being addressed internationally, and this is set to continue for quite some time to come. It will do so well, less well, it may do so badly. But as far as the international community is concerned, the question that is going to count is whether or not believers are being treated in accordance with international human rights standards. They are the benchmark. In the time available, what I wish to do is to consider a number of recent developments which, in my view, suggest there is an opportunity and, at the same time, a need for new thinking on how best to proceed in order to advance the freedom of religion and belief at an international level as a human right. There are a couple of general points I would also wish to make at this stage. First, and obviously, the rights of religious believers can and are protected by many other rights, in addition to the freedom of religion or belief itself. Examples would be the right to life, freedom from torture and inhuman or degrading treatment, the freedom of expression, the freedom of association, as well as more procedurally oriented rights concerning detention, fair trial, the rule of law, etc., etc. These are all very valuable safeguards and adds to the attraction of human rights as a means of addressing the vulnerabilities of religious believers in many societies. At the same time, there is, in my view, a need for the freedom of religion or belief to be addressed as a human right directly, and not merely as an adjunct to others. For those who adhere to forms of religion or belief, their beliefs represent foundational elements of their very conception of life. A rights-based approach which fails to acknowledge and respect this reality is diminished and is inevitably going to lack legitimacy. Secondly, when I speak of international human rights law as a tool, I am not only referring to its institutional machinery, such as its various councils, committees, rapporteurs, etc., the strengths and weaknesses of which need not detain us. I'm also referring to the power of the idea of human rights and of human rights approaches when properly mediated through domestic, regional, and international political processes to influence the application of domestic law and administrative practice. Whilst this offers no quick fix to the most egregious examples of abuse, it does offer real opportunities for worthwhile, if sometimes rather incremental, development. The first conclusion, I think, to be drawn from what I've said so far is that if faith communities wish to make a positive contribution to the protection of religious liberty, they must be prepared to fully engage with human rights approaches and fully engage with the relevant domestic, political, domestic, regional, and international political processes, and to do so in an informed and credible way. The latter, credibility, is the more difficult of these two desiderata, as there is, I think, a certain asymmetry which does need to be overcome. It is generally accepted and expected that states will work internationally in their own self-interest and in the interests of their nationals as well as in the interests of others. It is also generally accepted as quite appropriate for non-governmental organisations to take an instrumental approach aimed at the realisation of their own organisational goals. But when organised religions seek to act in precisely the same way, it is often seen negatively and as exemplifying the problem with religion, which is that believers are prone to act inappropriately by seeking to influence matters which are not their business. But of course, religious liberty is the business of faith communities. The problem, perhaps, is that they are often seen as being interested, perhaps only or too much, in the rights of their own, and not in the equivalent rights of others. Regrettably, this is sometimes, indeed, perhaps sometimes often, the case. Many religious communities and organisations insist that they stand for freedom of religion and belief for all, yet the number of religious communities and organisations, which as a central part of their work on freedom of religion or belief, routinely defend the rights of people of other faiths and belief, is not as large as one might wish it. the predominant interest which faith communities sometimes show in the rights of their own is also quickly discerned by diplomats and others with whom religious communities seek to engage on human rights matters. But whatever the reason for this, there is a barrier here which religious communities do, I think, need to seek to overcome if they are to be listened to. And unless and until that barrier is overcome, the ability of the international community to engage effectively with the protection of the freedom of religion as a human right will be diminished. For the want of those with a key stake in the process, the faith communities themselves, being able to find an effective way of fully engaging with the process. But the process? But what is there to engage with? The freedom of religion or belief has not fared particularly well as a human right when compared to some other issues. The 1948 Universal Declaration on Human Rights sets out in Article 18 the basic approach which has been followed in most other international human rights instruments. That approach is based on the idea that religion or belief is essentially a matter of individual choice and that everyone should have the freedom to hold whatever form of belief, religious or otherwise, that they wish. This inner freedom, in the lawyer's Latin, the forum internum, canon lawyers, please don't go there, is complemented by the freedom to act in accordance with the beliefs which one holds. This being achieved by recognising the additional right to manifest one's religion or belief in a number of ways, through teaching, worship, observance and practice. The exercise of this right to manifest one's religion or belief may, however, be restricted in order to protect the rights and freedoms of others, provided that such restrictions are proportionate to the legitimate aim pursued. That, in a nutshell, provides the basic framework within which the debate concerning the contours and practical application of the freedom of religion or belief takes place. For all its iconic status, the Universal Declaration was not intended to be a direct source of legal obligation. The usual pattern of standard setting that has emerged within the United Nations is for a non-binding declaration to be adopted by the General Assembly and then for a legally binding convention to be drafted and opened for adoption, with this providing the source of legal obligation. It was as far back as 1956 that the United Nations first decided to undertake further work on the freedom of religion or belief, a process that culminated in a report in 1960 setting out 18 draft principles. Then in 1962, the General Assembly decided that declarations and conventions should be drafted on the twin topics of racial discrimination and on discrimination based on religion or belief, the idea that both processes were complementary and would proceed together in tandem. Whilst the Declaration on Religious Discrimination was adopted in 1963 and the Convention in 1965, progress regarding religion took a rather different trajectory. Oddly, it was decided to draft a convention before the Declaration, and this process ground to a halt in 1967, and it has not been returned to since. In the meanwhile, and belatedly, attention switched back to the idea of drafting a declaration, and this was duly completed some 14 years later, in 1981, and this year we mark its 30th anniversary. But what happened to the convention, which would have provided a more detailed, comprehensive and rounded source of legal obligation concerning the freedom of religion? The short answer is basically nothing. For many years now, it has been the received wisdom that it would be, quote, premature to return to this task. This is a view I have previously subscribed to myself, but it is a view which I no longer hold. Why? The reluctance to return to this topic has largely been driven by the worry that it might result in a lowering of existing standards rather than in the raising of them. The archetypal example of this concern relates to the freedom to change one's religion or belief, though there are others. The Universal Declaration, and for that matter the European Convention on Human Rights, expressly provides that the freedom of religion includes the freedom to change one's religion. This express right is not found in the 1966 International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which merely speaks of the right to have or to adopt a religion of one's choice. The 1981 Declaration takes a further step backwards, referring only to the right to have a religion. Although it is routinely argued that the right to change one's religion is inherent in the very concept of the freedom of religion or belief, this is not universally accepted. And if any reminder of this were needed, attempts were made to insert a reference to the right to change one's religion in the annual resolution on the freedom of religion or belief being debated before the UN Human Rights Council in March of this year. But this attempt was unsuccessful. It simply could not be achieved. At its most basic, the arguments against returning to the drafting of a UN convention all come down to the argument that it would be unwise to run the risk of unsettling the consensus that exists around existing standards. This argument now, I think, fails on at least three counts. First, it fails because that consensus is largely absent. There is very little consensus. At best, there is a consensus around the general approach found in the Universal Declaration, but only in the most abstract of fashions. As I have said, not only has there been pushback on some elements of Article 18, but there is also little real consensus over how it is to be applied in practice, as perhaps evidenced by the controversies unleashed by decisions of the European Court of Human Rights applying similarly worded Article 9 of the ECHR on a variety of issues such as bans on headscarves in universities in Turkey, the appropriateness of forms of religious education in state school curricula, the presence of crucifixes in classrooms, and much else besides. Moreover, the thin consensus around the approach exemplified in Article 18 is increasingly fragile, based as it is upon there being the clear public-private divide, with human rights principles simply policing the middle ground of contestation. But this clear public-private divide is fast disappearing into an ever-expanding grey zone in which it seems that almost everything is up for grabs. Secondly, the argument against unsettling the consensus fails, I would argue, on the grounds that, to the extent that there is a current consensus, it has done little to combat the rising tide of restriction, hostility, and violence experienced by many religious believers. The achievements of the current consensus position are not so impressive that it would be running too great a risk to open it up to debate. Thirdly, and perhaps most decisively, perhaps it's already too late. That debate has already been opened up. But rather than being conducted in an open, clear and transparent fashion, focusing on enhancing the level of protections offered to all those whose religious freedoms are under threat, it has been done in ways which, in my view, tend to do perhaps more harm than good. These being the so-called debates on defamation of religions and what one might describe as the rise of the phobias. Thinking first of the defamation of religions debate, it is beyond doubt that the freedom of religion has a collective dimension. However, this does not mean that human rights law should be used by individuals or by religious bodies to promote particular religious values or to protect believers or beliefs from critical or even offensive comment. Nor should it be used to restrain others from behaving in ways which believers deem to be inappropriate. There are some caveats to this, but they need not concern us for the moment. The starting point for human rights law should be the right of the individual believer, alone or in community with others, to hold and to act in accordance with their beliefs. Generally speaking, it is only if the level of adverse comment, criticism, or behaviour reaches a level of intensity that prejudices the ability of a believer to exercise their own freedom of religion or belief that grounds for intervention arise. Nevertheless, this has not prevented concerted efforts being made within international fora to support the very opposite idea. The idea that states should be entitled to use their legal powers to restrict those who seek to defame a religion. The claim is that restrictions should be applied to those who fail to respect the values of the religious system in question. It is on the basis of such approaches that action is taken against those who oppose apostasy or blasphemy laws, for example. It is also on this basis that action is taken against those whose lifestyles or mores do not accord with those espoused by the dominant religious traditions. The precise parameters of the idea have always been rather vague, but this has not stopped the United Nations from adopting a resolution annually since 1999 in support of restrictions on those who defame religions, albeit with ever declining majorities. Since the resolutions were couched in the language of the promotion of tolerance and respect, it is easy to see why these resolutions resonated with many, but over time, their repressive potential has come to be recognised. As a result, the language used in the resolutions began to shift away from defamation of religions and towards the more widely accepted language associated with combating incitement to religious hatred. In March of this year, it appeared that the defamation debate had finally been put to rest when the Organisation of the Islamic Conference, the body which has been coordinating the defamation resolutions, failed to put forward a resolution on this topic, but presented and secured the adoption, without a vote, of a snappily entitled resolution on, quote, combating intolerance, negative stereotyping and stigmatisation of, and discrimination, incitement to violence and violation against persons based on religion or belief. Inter alia, this resolution calls on states to foster religious freedom and pluralism by promoting the ability of members of all religious communities to manifest their religion and to contribute openly and on an equal footing to society, but its principal thrust is on the need to tackle incitement to religious hatred. There is no doubt that this marks a significant and welcome change in approach, both practically and conceptually. There is, however, still a major difficulty with approaches based on incitement, and this concerns the point at which one seeks to intervene to prevent incitement from occurring. At one end of the spectrum lies intervention in order to prevent the imminent risk of violence. At the other lies intervention in order to suppress forms of expression or activity which challenges, questions, or merely runs contra to the values of others and which they might object to do so as an early precautionary measure against such incitful behaviour emerging. It is fair to say that the recent UN resolution lies closer to the former and the more welcome end of the spectrum than the latter, although traces of the latter are also to be found within it. But that notwithstanding, it may be that celebration is premature. Less than 1 month after the resolution was passed, in a quite extraordinary situation, in an ad hoc group on complementary standards, this is the rather opaque name given to the process arising out of the Durban Review Conference on Racial Discrimination to consider strengthening action against racial discrimination by undertaking further standard-setting activity. At its session of this complementary standards group in April, the newly elected chair, having first attempted to adopt a blank agenda — committee's chair, do note the advantage of adopting a blank agenda so that no one would know in advance what they have agreed to discuss — was persuaded to identify at least some of the proposed topic in advance. And one of the four that the chair was persuaded to reveal concerned the parameters of incitement to religious hatred, which immediately raised concern in some quarters that precisely the same issues were about to come back yet again in another guise. And there are more examples of such things having happened. The point I wish to make is simply this: the realisation that defamation of religions was more likely to serve as a tool of repression than as a tool of religious freedom resulted in the language of the debate being shifted to the more widely accepted and legitimated language of combating incitement to religious hatred. And who, in principle, is going to object to that? The problem lies in the malleable contours of that concept. And it may well be that all that has happened is the substance of the issue has just been transformed from one forum to another. In other words, the forces which seek to subvert the freedom of religion and convert it into a means of repression may remain alive, well, and focused on the role. The question which continually gets lost in these twists and turns is really rather simple, but really rather important. And it is, why not start with the idea of the freedom of religion and belief for everyone, rather than focusing on the action to be taken against those who denigrate the beliefs of others? Tackling those who gratuitously attack religious believers is, of course, an important element of a protective framework, but it can hardly comprise that framework, or indeed provide its appropriate starting point. In reality, most of the restrictions placed on the freedom of religion or belief, and therefore much of the hostility and violence which believers face, are not the product of anti-religious sentiment within the populace at large, or only the product of this. They are often a result of the negative stereotyping, antipathy, or downright hostility displayed by many state systems, either to certain forms of religion or belief in particular, or to all forms of religion or belief in general. Calling upon states to address these problems by taking action against those who denigrate religion is all very well, but such an approach fails spectacularly to address the overriding problem, which is how to hold states to account for their own failure to respect and protect the rights of all believers. This, I would suggest, would be a much better place to start, and is at the heart of what international human rights commitments under international law are actually all about. Of course, it is very tempting for religious communities to accept the protection and support which a state might offer them, even when that support takes the form of, ultimately, acting in a repressive way as regards the rights of others. And it can be very difficult to champion the rights of those whose views one might believe to be profoundly wrong. Yet if religious communities are interested in furthering the freedom of religion or belief, this is exactly what they must do. Faith communities must reject the superficial attractions of claiming or accepting such freedoms for themselves alone, and unhesitatingly support the freedom of religion or belief for all. Unless or until religious communities are prepared to champion for everyone the freedoms that they wish for their own followers to enjoy, there is likely to be little opportunity for seriously furthering the freedom of religion or belief at all. A second area in which developments have taken place is in the related field of tackling anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Both are discernible phenomena which are founded on hatred, prejudice, or fear, and both are causes of serious concern. It is right that they be tackled. But how? There are, I think, considerable dangers in tackling the hostility experienced by some religious groups by offering them heightened degrees of legal protection which are not necessarily offered to others. As we know only too well, those who consider themselves to be the subject of the same disabilities, but are excluded from the scope of such protections provided, inevitably become aggrieved, and this sort becomes a source of friction, as we know from the troubled history of blasphemy laws, both in this country and elsewhere. And do we want to encourage a competitive approach to victim status? Should we develop concepts of Baha'iophobia or Jehovah's Witnessophobia, given that in different parts of the world, followers of both these traditions experience extremely serious violations of their rights and freedoms? Yet this has already happened, to some acclaim, as regards Christianity itself. It is true enough that an increasing number of Christians have begun to feel increasingly marginalised within parts of Western Europe, as general societal assumptions concerning the place of Christianity within the order of things has evolved. This has taken place at a time in which the extent of anti-Christian violence in other parts of the world has been both increasing and, perhaps equally important, has become increasingly visible. There has been some conflating of these two separate phenomena, despite their extremely different contexts, and as a result, there has been an increasing number of calls for action to be taken against discrimination against Christians or Christianophobia. There are many examples of this, and in March of 2009, the Organisation on Security and Cooperation in Europe organised the first ever round table on discrimination against Christians within an international organisation. And this language has now become fairly commonplace in political fora. There has also been changes taking place in other fora. We notice for the first time the European Union has become more vocal and active as regards matters of freedom of religion and belief, and in particular focusing on issues to do with Christians in third states outside of the European Union. And the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe has proceeded down the same route. The OSCE returns to the subject in September of this year with a special meeting on preventing and responding to hate incidents and crimes against Christians. After a wilderness period, a Christian agenda is firmly established on the political map alongside anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. At one level, this focus on the issues is to be welcomed. But as I have said, there are potential dangers in this approach. Organised religions should not be entering into an unhealthy competition with each other in order to gain recognition as a particularly persecuted category, in order that they are able to gain the attention of such political processes. What would be the threshold of persecution which needs to be crossed? Do we want to encourage competition for victim status? Moreover, all this does is magnify the perception that those involved in advancing such concerns, no matter how legitimate they may be, might be motivated by preference or partisanship. And this serves only to undermine both the effectiveness and the legitimacy of the views expressed or the action taken in the eyes of those to whom they are addressed. As a result, such approaches run the risk of fueling the very hostility which they are intended to address. Whilst it is entirely proper that the particular needs of particular groups are highlighted when it is appropriate to do so, the problem is that, like the defamation debate, phobiaism has become a surrogate for the lack of progress or the unwillingness to address the underlying issue, which is the lack of a real appreciation and understanding of and commitment to the freedom of religion and belief for all. But are there signs of change? I think there are. It would be wrong of me to move towards the end of this address without noting that the United Kingdom Foreign Office has recently highlighted the freedom of religion or belief as a key human rights concern, a concern further highlighted in the Foreign Secretary's Easter message and in its annual human rights report. The European Union, as I mentioned, is also now taking a much keener interest and will be developing its strategies and approaches in the months to come. There is then a great deal of thinking taking place, but it is taking place in disparate and disconnected fora. Not only is this disconnected approach undesirable in its own right, it also makes it much more difficult for others, including religious communities, to know what is happening and to become involved. As I have already said, I do consider it essential that religious communities find effective ways of contributing to such developments in an open, non-partisan fashion. Perhaps even more importantly, I believe it to be essential that they try to influence the manner in which the freedom of religion is addressed by the international community, and that they encourage it to be focused upon what the freedom of religion or belief means, on what it requires and of whom it is required. Rather than being a celebration of a thing of worth, the approach currently adopted by the international political community remains focused on restrictions on the rights of others and is dominated by the language of special pleading, of disadvantage, of hostility and of hate. I think this must change. I have no doubt that freedom of religion or belief is attaining a prominence in international affairs unforeseen and largely unforeseeable even 5, let alone 10 years ago. At one level, the reasons for this are distressingly negative, based as it is on increasing levels of repression and violence against believers of many faiths. But there does not seem to be any momentum within the international community to address the issues at the heart of the problem. Instead, the dominant agendas are those which I have mentioned: defamation of religions, incitement to religious hatred, combating anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, Christianophobia, discrimination against Christians, and so on. These agendas all run the risk of being rather self-defeating by being perhaps overly self-serving, particularly if they are the only agendas which are being pursued. Hence, there is a pressing need to return to the wellspring from which all else flows, but from which there seems to be a reluctance to draw. It involves developing a more precise understanding of what the freedom of religion as a human right actually entails, and to do so in a coherent and transparent fashion to which all interested parties can contribute. We might then be better placed to develop the means by which that vision can be realised. It is quite some agenda. It will require the willingness to stand back from the advancement of partisan agendas, look beyond immediate concerns of and for co-religionists, and whilst seeking to address those concerns as best one might, not to lose sight of the need to ensure that everyone should be able to enjoy their religion or belief, whatever that might be. This ought to be our entry point into the question, and reconsidering the question of whether we should recommence the process of producing a global legal instrument on the freedom of religion or belief might be a very good place to start. It might start rolling back the essentially negative approaches of recent years and championing a more positive vision of what religious freedom has to offer. There is, I think, no belief that the freedom of religion and belief will ever mean untrammelled respect for the particular views of religious communities that fails to take into account the disparate perspectives and the rights and freedoms of others. In domestic debates, we rightly hear concerns as regards discrimination against other marginalised groups within society, and so on. There will always be balances to be struck. But the danger, if not the difficulty, that I think we are currently facing is that our reluctance to engage with the core approach of the freedom of religion for the want of having to accept that compromises may need to be made around the margins of application in these difficult and hard cases runs the risk of blinding us to the attractions, the opportunities, and I would argue the necessity of advancing a robust case for the freedom of religion and belief, restrictions and all, as providing the essential platform on which to assure, or attempt to assure, the realisation of the most basic freedoms for many in many countries where these most basic freedoms of worship, of assembly, of belief are simply not enjoyed. What should Christians and those of other faiths do to further the freedom of religion or belief? As people of faith, it is up to us to champion the causes of others as well as of ourselves. And we must do this based on a positive understanding of the value of freedom of religion or belief for all, grounded as that belief is in our own understanding of church, conscience, and the common good. For if religious believers will not stand up for the religious freedoms of others, irrespective of their faiths, why in heaven's name should anybody else? Thank you very much.